back, everyone, to another episode of Investing in Real Estate. I am your host, Clayton Morris. Thank you so much for downloading and subscribing to the show. We've gotten such a great response on our case study episodes. We do them once a week, and today is no different. We are joined by a full-time sales manager and really gets to do real estate part-time. But he's acquired quite a number of properties using some different unique strategies, and he would really like to do real estate full time if he could, but one step at a time. And his name is Chris Kuchera, and we are thrilled to have him on the podcast tonight to really dive into some of his strategies. Chris, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks, Clayton. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So you and I just met pretty recently, actually. I think we had a sort of offline discussion just about real estate. You had reached out to me and we just got to talking, and I loved your story. And I thought, you know what, here's the power of the internet and podcasting, is that I think my audience would really get a great benefit of hearing your story in real estate investing. And there's so many different turns and twists to acquiring properties, and you've certainly acquired properties in your own way, and I'd love to have my audience hear about that tonight, if that sounds like a plan.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So just kind of give me a little overview. When did you start getting into real estate investing? Take me back a few years.
Well, I'm currently 51 years old, so I've always had an interest since I was in my early 20s. I don't know why. Nobody in my family or anybody else had anything to do with real estate, but I think it was those infomercials back in the early 80s with Carlton Sheets and others.
And you bought everywhere. A course, right? You bought like a Carlton Sheets course, right?
I did. I was like 19 or 20 and knew nothing about real estate. I read it cover to cover, and actually somehow or another, through sheer will, I guess, I did manage to buy my first property when I was 21 from an owner that was for sale by owner, and a nice property in Bayville, New Jersey. And I talked him into letting me buy with no money down and pay him $600 a month for a year, and tried to rehab it and flip it. I didn't even know what I wanted to do then. I really was just taking action before I really was educated enough, but I felt a lot of drive to try to do something. So it didn't work out so great. It was before the first crash. I think it was, what, 80? What your time frame was that? I lose track of time. I think maybe 88 or something. I think there was another downturn back then. Not as bad as 2008. But we ended up, I went in with my brother-in-law. We went got out of it with our skin, but that was about it. And it kind of scared me off for about 20 years or so. I went about working and raising my daughter and take care of my wife. But it never really left me. So in my early 40s, about 9 years ago now, I decided that it was time to do something because I needed to have a plan in place. My motivation was really this time was really more about practicality. And for me, I needed some kind of retirement plan because I'm not going to count on Social Security.
Yeah. And then sort of really diving in and getting your feet wet. So how many properties do you currently own?
I own 10 single-family properties. I've purchased 8 in the last 2 years. So there's been kind of some light bulbs kind of went off for me the last couple of years, and I discovered private lenders and private financing, which for me, and for a lot of wannabe real estate investors, it's the cash and having the money to do the deals is always a big question. And my first two rental properties, actually, I bought, in the traditional fashion. I put 20% down and just kind of bought them the old fashioned way and was able to get them financed. So a lot of every one of the last 8 were REO, bank owned foreclosures. And
okay, there's a lot to unpack there. So yeah. We have a lot of new investors who listen to this show who, you know, they've listened to 80 other different podcasts. And so this podcast is laser focused around buy and hold investing, right? We're not talking wholesaling. We're not talking, wholesaling lease options or anything. Right. We're laser focused on building that passive income and legacy wealth like you're doing. So I want to kind of dive into some of your strategies that you employed in these eight to 10 properties. Obviously the first two, you use bank financing. Now, I want to dissect those two. Okay. There are a lot of our listeners who maybe have great credit scores. I know I've talked to a lot of them recently who say, you know, I've got 800. That's in my, you know, my credit score is 800. Mm-hmm. So they're thinking about maybe going the traditional financing route for at least their first few properties. Would you suggest that that's a smart move?
I think it is. If you've got the means, if you know, for me, I mean, I still didn't have a lot of cash, but I did have a lot of equity in my house and I had a home equity line, and I basically used the home equity line as my 20% down on deal one and deal two. And, money is cheap. You know, these rates, we've kind of taken it for granted these last however many years.
Yeah, early 80s, they were like 18% interest rates.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember, you know, when I got a 6.5, maybe even 10 years ago, refinanced on my house, how great I thought that was. You know, now 3.5 or whatever it is. So, yeah, the money's cheap. And if you're looking at just a cash flow, have monthly income off of each property to maximize that, there's really no replacing 30-year fixed bank. You know, it's locked in stone. And once you've got that, as long as you hang on to that, you know, I think Warren Buffett said you never sell a performing asset, something like that. But, you know, if it's making you $200-$400 a month, why would you sell that? You know, you just got to start doing the math on how many of those you need.
So that's a great way to kind of kickstart things, right? To kind of get your feet wet where you're not as knee deep, right? So it's a nice little way to kind of sink your teeth into it, I guess. And if you can find these properties. Now, where did you find these properties initially, the ones that you bought with bank financing? Did they need rehab? Because I know a lot of concern from investors as well, you know, like the properties I buy and that we sell to our clients is that they are, some of them, you know, need total rehab and we do a full rehab on our properties. So would a bank put their money on that or no?
Most of the properties that we've purchased, the first two are the exception. The first two, I'll just kind of forget those for now because I didn't buy those right. I wasn't fully educated and I pretty much paid retail minus 20% down. But the next eight where I really kind of had an idea of what I was doing, they were all either, you know, bank owned or I think there were a couple of HUD houses. But yeah, every one of them needed some rehab. Most of them were pretty rough shape, but mostly cosmetically, because for my particular, you know, model that I've set up for my criteria of the type houses that I'm looking for or will buy. One of the criteria is like 20 years or younger. So I'm buying newer houses. That's intentional because I don't want a lot of maintenance.
So let's dive into some of the, well, actually, before we get into the private financing side, I'm curious because you mentioned your contractor. So obviously you're doing these kind of locally. You had the time. Would you recommend, I don't want to lead the witness here because I know where I stand. I know where I stand on this, you know, which is having someone else handle things for you. But or do you recommend diving in and really working with, you know, contractors and all of that and getting your hands dirty and really trying to go through and like learn what kind of fixtures and plumbing and all that kind of stuff? How did you kind of accelerate your learning on that?
No, I really don't. When I got my real estate mentoring really from a group that I joined out of Texas, one of the things I learned was to build a great team. And, so I'm actually a 2-hour drive from all my properties. So I'm not real local. And but I used to live in the town where they're located. So I know it well. I do know the market. And but building a great team is critical. So I proceeded to go about doing that. And over the course of the last few years, I've just got great people. I've got a great electrician, you know, a plumber. I've got kind of a general handyman builder that does just about everything. He's the perfect guy's honest. And, you know, if you find a great contractor and somebody you have a rapport with, it's just so valuable. And, but I've got a termite guy, and I try to, you know, find people I like and people I trust and build a relationship with them and give them repeat business. And, you know, you take care of them and they start taking care of you. And, so I don't really do any of the work. I am a handy guy. I know construction. I know, you know, I've been around all my life, but, so I have an idea and I kind of go in and tell them what I want to do. I know what I want to do. You know, I have certain, I'm looking for low maintenance materials like ceramic tile in the kitchen and baths. I use a kind of a higher grade laminate in the living areas, living room, hallway.
High traffic area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't buy the cheap laminate. I don't like the cheap, you know, 50 cent laminate that looks like cheap 50 cent laminate. You know, I buy good stuff, 10, 12 mil with the backing on it, dark, nice colors. Looks like real hardwood. I mean, it's really good stuff.
Right. Right. That's what we do in a lot of ours. Yeah. Dealing with it yourself is one way to go. Now let's dive into the private financing side of this. So on the first two, we kind of chalk those up to learning pains, growing pains. I mean, I kind of did the same thing. I bought my first two properties through a realtor. You know, I mean, we kind of laugh at that now, right? Like, I mean, I know we've got realtors listening to the show, but nothing, no offense. My dad's a realtor. My wife's a realtor, but, you know, let's be honest. Once it hits that like retail price.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there's no equity. Right. So what sort of an equity position first, before we dive into the private financing, do you look for now? I mean, given the first two, you paid like a retail price, put 20% down.
Right.
I mean, that's what I talk. You know, I talked to a lot of, you know, investors who they're like looking in their own backyard and they are like calling up local realtors. They drive around on the weekends and they think it kind of looks like a good deal. They're not really sure. Mm-hmm. What kind of equity position are you looking to pick up when you buy one of your properties now?
Well, and you're 100% right about that, and I hear you hitting on that often. You've got to go where the numbers make sense, you know. And it just so happened for me that the area I live in North Carolina, the numbers work. You know, the taxes are low, the insurance is cheap, and the price of houses, you know, the numbers work for, you know, a 3-2. You can make it work. So, what I'm looking for, because of the way that I financed the last eight with private lenders. My eye was always towards, when I was making a deal with a private lender, the loan might be for a year or two or even up to 4 years. But it's at a little higher interest rate than I'm ever going to get with the bank. So I always made my deals with an eye towards having to refinance or wanting to refinance with a bank at low interest at 30-year amortization, you know, so that I could maximize my cash flow. So when I'm, you know, structuring these deals, I know that I need to have 25% equity left in the house even after I've spent money on the rehab. So it depends on the house, but usually that would mean I would have to buy the house at 35 to 40% below after repaired value, you know, initially.
Right.
And then after I put 10 or 12 grand or whatever it was in it, I'd still have, you know, 25 or close enough to 25%, so that when I go to a bank to refinance, that's what they're looking for in an investment property. They want 25% minimum. And basically, if you don't have it, you're going to have to bring the cash to closing. You can still get the deal done, but it's, you know, so that was always the goal. And I pretty much hit that with these last eight.
So are you doing cash out refinances on the backside? And for our listeners who are new to this idea, right, it's the idea that you're acquiring a few properties. So maybe you buy 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 properties. And then after you've acquired them, they're rehabbed, you have a tenant in place, you go to a local bank or maybe another private lender and you say, look, would you mind, you know, here are the properties. Here's the cash flow. Here's the after repair value. Here's what they're worth. Here's how much I owe. Mm-hmm. Would you like to place a note on these properties? 75% loan to value roughly, and I'm going to pull the cash out of these properties. There's the equity there. So is that what you're doing on these?
It's not. If the equity were there, you know, I might consider it, but, you know, I'm cutting it close by the time I'm done rehabbing. I'm, you know, right at 25, 23, 27% equity. So there's really not a lot of cash to pull out in the first place. But beyond that, it is a word of warning, I think, for all of us, I think, is, you know, you don't want to be over leveraged. You know, that's, I'm making maximum use of leverage with using other people's money and putting very little of my own money in it because I'm even borrowing the rehab money. You know, I think it's good to have a little cushion and,
Right. People were over leveraged back then.
Find other ways to get your deals done, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there was so much over leveraging going on back in 2008. So people had, you know, they didn't have a good equity position when they were leveraging their properties, or they were in speculative areas, or, you know, areas where they saw a lot of volatility, you know, a lot of volatility.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, you're in an area that was, I think, pretty well insulated from a lot of the craziness of 2008, where I buy my properties in the Midwest is, you know, in certain cities was really insulated from a lot of the craziness. Where my parents live in Pennsylvania was really insulated from a lot of the craziness. Now, places like New York City, San Francisco, Phoenix, you know.
It did drop some. I'll give you the one example. But this is also, I guess, a lesson in how forgiving real estate is as an investment. My very first house I bought, which I bought the traditional way, 20% down, I paid too much for. I paid $114,000 for the house. At the time, that was about right for the retail value. But that was 2006. 2008 comes along, and it did take, you know, a bump, certain areas, certain neighborhoods. So this house got as low as far as its retail value, as low as about $80,000. It was, you know, basically below what I owed on it for a lot of years. And that's been creeping back up now. The same house I paid 114 for is now probably about 108, 109. So it's coming back. But, you know, it didn't matter is the point.
See, you and I talked the other day. This is what I want to hit on. When you said that to me, and I think I want people to pay attention to that, it didn't matter. So why didn't it matter?
Because I was cash flowing every month, making my $300 a month off that house. And I didn't care what it was worth at that point. I mean, I wasn't ready to sell it. You know, for me, I'm buy and hold. This isn't going anywhere. And I've got a 30-year mortgage, so I'm golden. You know?
So that's the amazing part of this. So I think what a lot of people get scared about, obviously we're coming out of this era where we had the 2008 crash. And I say to people all the time, you know, I know folks who had, you know, 79 properties outside of Detroit,
right?
Or 100 properties in other cities in the Midwest. And yeah, maybe their values dropped. You know, they were worth 50 and they dropped to 38,000, whatever, you know. It didn't matter though, because they were renting for $725 a month.
Nice.
And, you know, and they're not, what are they going to drop their rent to $700 a month? $675 a month? I mean,
right. The rents didn't really fall. That was the nice thing. The
rents
about the same. You know?
So your rents stayed the same.
Yeah, basically, yeah. So They're up a little bit, you know, as, You know how it is. The rental market right now is very strong, and houses, I usually, if I have a vacancy, they rented usually within a week or two.
That's the amazing thing. So I want people to really, really hear that. I mean, the fear I hear from a lot of investors is, well, what about another downturn? Mm-hmm. And if you're buying for long term buy and hold, where you are cash flowing in stable markets, where, you know, where Chris and I are talking about, like I said, you're not going to drop rents. You know, maybe you're renting at $825 a month. What are you going to drop it $25? Who's that really helping? You know, now if you're New York City and you've got a high rise building and you're renting for, you know, $3,800 a month on a one bedroom apartment. And then, you know, the city kind of takes a dive and you're now having to rent for $2,300. That's a whole different animal.
Yeah. Different story. Yeah. That's exactly right. And, you know, I think it's people are always going to have a place to live, right? So just drive down the road and, you know, everywhere you turn, there are houses. People have to have a place, and they're not building houses like they used to. You know, the construction side of things is still relatively slow. They're building a lot of apartments, maybe too many. But, you know, there's a lot of people don't want to live in an apartment. You got to do your homework and see what everybody else and what the market is giving and, you know, what the rents are going for.
Right.
And if the average for the type of house I have is 950, then I'll put mine out for 925. So
that's exactly what we do. I mean, that's exactly. So, you know, when people want to know about rent and why we don't have vacancies in our properties. I mean, that's the key right there. When people want to do, you know, 950 or 800 and you know, we go 775 because I'd rather have no vacancy. And at the same time, like you, you know, we want to have our properties fully rehabbed so that when they come home at the end of the day, they've got a great, you know, great property, right? So they're walking into new plumbing, new electrical, you know, new kitchen, new bath, you know, new windows, paint, carpet.
Sounds like you guys do a really nice job on those. I have yet to see any of those, but I'll get with you after on that. And I'm curious to, you know, what you're doing out there in the Midwest. So I've known that's a good market for, you know, heard a lot of investors talk about, you know, that area.
Yeah, we love it. And we, you know, and just like you said, you know, like low taxes, but really hitting those numbers. I want to dive in now with what little time we have left here. I'd love to talk about your, you know, your private financing. I'm sure people are sitting there with a pen and a paper right now because I was so heartened. I couldn't wait to tell my wife after you and I talked the other day. I said, Chris did it exactly like we did in getting our private financing. And I've been trying to preach this message to as many of the investors I talk to on the phone, the exact same strategy. And it seems very basic, but how did you, when the first day you said, I'm going to get some private financing in place, what is the first thing you did? I want everyone paying attention right now to hear this.
First thing I did was I joined the local real estate investors club, the local REIA.
They're all over the place, right? How'd you find it?
They're everywhere. I'm out in Asheville, North Carolina. There's one there. There's one in Greenville, South Carolina, which is not too far. They kind of work together. Yeah, they're in every city, Charlotte, Raleigh, and then every other town. So, yeah, it's a good thing. It's a great place to network and meet people. And I got to come clean. I'm not the best member because I don't attend a lot of stuff. I really don't. But
here's the thing. There's so many people that sit behind a computer and sit behind podcasts and sit behind books and make excuses for why they can't on a Wednesday night. For instance, you know, I try to go, there's like three in my area in New Jersey, and I try to go as much as I can every month. And even though I'm not doing deals in New Jersey, you know, I'm not buying real estate in New Jersey because I'm not doing buy and hold investing in New Jersey. You'd be insane, you know, but there are a lot of flippers there. There are a lot of private money guys there. There are a lot of hard money guys there. There are a lot of realtors. And when you can like really like pick people's brains and be genuine and open and just be transparent, like go there and be like, look, I am literally just getting started and I need your help. Point me in the right direction. People like that when you're just honest. You don't have to be fake when you go to these meetings.
You know, I went to a meeting or two. I wasn't, you know, barely, you know, started in being a member. And one of the little things that came along with it was our local group anyway has a Yahoo groups page. But one day I saw a lady had posted that her and her partners had some money to lend, and she stipulated her terms. And so I didn't respond on the groups page, but her email address was there. So I emailed her privately and, you know, reached out to her and introduced myself and told her I'd like to get together for a cup of coffee. And, that, you know, I was an investor. I was looking to grow and add a lot of properties and, you know, I just gave her a little bio. I think I mentioned to you when we talked privately, I had built, something I was taught to do in my training. I tried to build a credibility kit, they call it, but basically it's a,
yeah, this is what I want to get to. So, all right, okay. Everyone paying attention. Chris, we did the same thing, my wife and I, and this has been a game changer. And I talk to people on the phone about this idea of a credibility kit or a one-page sort of synopsis, right? So what did you do in your credibility kit?
Well, yeah, and mine is I got to tell you, it's more, you know, it's more like a four-page PDF document, but I built it in Word, and basically it's a personal bio, just about a little bit of who you are and, where I was born and raised, and a little bit about my family life and about my wife and daughter and granddaughters. And, you know, I included a couple of pictures of my wife and I and my, you know, my daughter and granddaughters. And, you know, so the personal side, then I also had a work bio, you know, my history of my quote real job, you know, career, you know, and what I do there to you know, get paid every week. And, so that was, you know, the gist of it. I did have those two first properties So I did have a couple investment properties that I also listed. I had photos of the properties and where they were. And, you know, I mean, granted, I didn't necessarily buy them the right way, but hey, they were investment properties. So anything that you can do to build just a little, you know, it's credibility. You're just trying to build some credibility with somebody. Hey, this guy's not just some clown. He's serious.
At the end of the day, you had access and you had a wherewithal for deals. And I think this is what a lot of people think, that, I'm never going to be able to get private money, right? I'm never going to be able to do it myself. And the bottom line is that people are making like a 2-3 and maybe a 4% return in the stock market. And, and they're getting hammered. And so if you can present to them real estate deals that you're able to, you know what you're doing, here's mm-hmm. what you would like to do more of, and you can find a really mutually beneficial relationship, right?
You really can. And I didn't realize how eager they are to lend you money. And you're right, because when you're out there and you're the words private money, you know, it's all kind of intimidating. It's all kind of an enigma. You don't really, you know, how is this actually going to come down? How's it going to happen? Well, you know, you can't always know everything. At some point you got to just start taking action and taking steps. And there's a saying that I like that basically says, you know, go as far as you can see. And then when you get there, you'll see further. And I've done that a lot in real estate. You know, I've come up against things that, you know, it's just fear of the unknown, whatever it may be. And you just forge ahead and you go and you learn, you ask questions, and, you know, that's really what's made the difference, Clayton, in the last, you know, couple of years. And, you know, you got to get the education, you know, the overused term of analysis paralysis. And it's true, but I think it's more than that. I don't think, and there are certain personality types that get stuck in analysis, but I think most people get stuck in fear of taking action.
Right. You know? And it's something really I teach my little boy, you know, a few years ago, 3 years old, you know, he loves Batman. I love Batman. So I would say to him, you know, when you have fear in your way, run towards it, because fear really is fake. It really doesn't exist. If you, right. At the end of the day, when you're standing there, sort of standing by yourself and you take a deep breath, everything is totally fine. When things are not fine is when you're focused on the past or you're focused on the future. And when you're focused on the future, it doesn't exist yet. And when you're focused on the past, that's gone. It doesn't even exist. Right. So you're literally totally 100% fine where you are right now. So the reason you're not moving forward is because you're fearful of something that doesn't even exist yet. It's crazy town. And almost always, right, it doesn't come to fruition, right? You may not want to go sit and talk to your boss because you're fearful of what he might say about your performance.
Yeah, we project, right?
Right. It's all garbage. You kind of created this relationship, but then it like improved over time. I mean, if you want to kind of talk about the terms a little bit, feel free. If not, whatever you're comfortable with.
No problem. It's not a big deal. So when it started out, the terms were, you know, they were pretty expensive.
So how did you ask for that? Did you say, I would like this, and they said, no, we would like this? Or did they come to you? How did that first happen? Because I know so many people at home, this will be like a little speed bump to them. It's like, well, did Chris ask or did they ask? How did that happen?
No. You know, when she posted on the Yahoo Groups page, she stipulated right there on the page her terms. And it was 12% interest. It was 2 points up front at closing, and then another point on the back end if and when, you know, refinanced and repay them. So it was expensive money, you know, at that rate, and at 12%, you know, even the deal I was going to buy, you know, wasn't going to make a lot of cash flow. It'd be probably break even to minimal cash flow. But it wasn't about that. I knew I had a plan to refinance eventually, and I just really wanted to do a deal this way with them, you know, and build some trust. So, I wanted it to be win-win. I wanted them to make money. But I bought the house well below its value. That particular one was, I paid $77,000 for it, 3-bedroom, 2-bath. It was like 10 years old, and it was worth about $125,000. And so it went well, and, you know, they made money. I paid them for, you know, about a year before I refinanced and paid them back. And actually, I didn't even wait till they were paid back. They had enough money to lend me on two properties. So I did two deals with them in the first year. And, you know, we built trust and friendship, and I built a track record with them. I always pay them on time. You know, they made good money. You know, they did very well, which is good. It had to be attractive for them. So anyway, long story short, when deal five came around and, you know, their money was paid back and it's sitting in their IRA, which is where they were lending it from, I knew they wanted to put it to work again, and I made their life easy. I went out and find the deals, and they just wired the money to the attorney. So I asked, you know, there's an old saying in sales, if you don't ask, you don't get.
Right. Did you need to bring any money when they lent you the money on those deals? Did you have to put any skin in the game?
No, great question. I didn't. Very rarely. I mean, I might have a little bit in it if I didn't figure my rehab correctly. And that's something you get better at over time, right? You learn quick. But no, most of them, I figured the rehab into it. So as an example, the one I sent you, Clayton, as a good case study, is there was a house that I paid from Bank of America foreclosure, $65,000 for. The after repaired value was about $125,000. And I borrowed from my private lenders to purchase the house. I borrowed 90. So I paid 65 to Bank of America, but I borrowed 90. So at closing, I walked out with a check after closing costs for about 23,000 and change. So I went and deposited it in my bank and started writing checks off it to pay contractors and materials. And when it was all said and done, I had that one figured, you know, really very well, almost to the dollar. And I didn't put hardly any money into it. It was all OPM, you know.
All other people's money. I love it. I mean, I just hope that people are paying attention to this because, you know, what Chris just laid out here was, you know, using traditional banks first, which I'm sure a lot of my listeners are thinking about right now, and then, you know, shifted into doing just putting together a simple little biography, going to the local real estate meeting, finding, a few local private lenders, paid a little bit more for the cash up front, but then developed a relationship, got that rate down, and now has 10 properties. And he didn't use any of his own money to do it.
That's right. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. It's
been fun. It's been a real, real learning experience. And the more you do, and you know this, you get the bug, the more excited you get. You start seeing a little bit of daylight as far as, you know, financial freedom and, you know, if you're only making, you know, my goal is actually 20. You know, that's when I started out. That was my goal. So I've got, you know, 10 more to hit that goal. And, you know, the next goal beyond getting to 20 is to start getting house one, you know, paid down, paid off would be ideal. And, you know, as I get older and decrepit and need to live off them, you know.
Right. But then, you know, that's the beauty of the, you know, Gary Keller's real estate, you know, millionaire real estate investor model. And, you know, such a great, great book that I encourage everyone to read regularly.
I did read that one.
You know, his, you know, buy, own, then cash flow. So you're in the buy phase, you know, it's like you buy them. Okay. We're not necessarily worried about the cash flow just yet. Just hold off a little bit more and, you know, get them fully free and clear, letting the rent pay them back, you know, in 5 years, 7 years, whatever they happen to be, whatever sort of leverage you put on them, try to keep it low, you know, and then, then as soon as they're all free and clear, they start popping free and clear, boom, boom, boom. And now all that cash flow becomes a reality. So, wonderful. Well, you know what I'd love to do is I would love to, if you are okay with this, share, and we can go through, I can have my assistant go through and make sure we pull out any private information that's in that example property that you sent me.
Yeah.
I would love to share it with my audience.
You should.
Fine. And I'll go through, and if there's anything we can talk offline, if there's anything private in there, you know, that we can block out and make sure that's not, you know, not relevant.
I think it's pretty clean. I pretty much already did that, so it should be good to post. But,
good. So, explain to me what we're looking at on that. So when people download it, what can they expect to see on that?
Okay, it was just, you know, I'm kind of a spreadsheet guy. I just got all kinds of spreadsheets for everything, and it's just me. I self-manage my properties as well, but you know, so I'd like to look back and see how I did. So after it was all said and done in this particular deal, and I had all the costs, you know, in, and I knew, you know, what it actually cost me to finish that house and rehab it. It's basically got my total cost, you know, what I paid for the house, what it was worth after repaired value, and shows you what I spent out of pocket. In this case study, I spent, it was the one we just talked about. I paid 65, I borrowed 90, it was worth 125, actually 127. But I put $182 of my own money in that deal, which was not too painful. So basically, as far as cash on cash returns go, it's infinite. You know, you really can't calculate it, but it, I had no money in the deal. And so it's a maximum use of leverage. And, you know, it's really the way to go. If you still have that 25% equity for refinancing down the road and you've got a little buffer, you can't beat it.
That's great. That's great. Well, Chris, it's been my great pleasure to have you here on the show. And I know that my audience is going to get a great value out of today's episode. I want to thank you again. We're going to have links to everything in the show notes. Chris's spreadsheet, so you can download that, take a look at the property. And Chris, thank you so much for joining us on the show. We really appreciate it.
A pleasure, Clay. And I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
And my thanks to all of you for downloading and subscribing to this episode. Again, please head over to morrisinvest.com/podcast. There you can download the spreadsheet. You can also have access to the Freedom Number cheat sheet that we were talking about. It's our free 3-page PDF that'll kind of, as Chris was mentioning on the show, let you really drill down, dive in, and find out what your financial freedom number is, how many houses it will take for you to achieve financial freedom. So all of the resources and everything we talked about on today's show are right there. And we'll see you back here next week, everyone, with another episode of Investing in Real Estate. I'm Clayton Morris. Have a great one, everyone.